I'm Sam, I'm a compulsive overeater. Growing up, I was the fattest kid in school. I grew up in Long Island, New York, in Great Neck. And if you listen to that reading is completely different than the way I think and the way I behave before I got here. It's really hard for a child to raise a man. And that's what happened in my family. I had a mother who was really mentally ill. And by the age of 4, I was compulsively overeating. By the time I was 13, I weighed 186. I don't think I was 5 feet tall. I did everything. I went to North Shore Hospital in Long Island, had, you know, an obesity clinic. I forget what it was. I did every diet. And always I was looking, this child raising a man, how to fix my problem, constantly. And if you listen to that reading this morning, it says you don't have to do that. We don't have to do that. By the time I was 16 or 17, I weighed 240 pounds. And doing terribly at school, my family, my mother was really mentally ill. And I can go to those causes and conditions and say, well, that's the reason why I'm a compulsive overeater. I don't know. I have no idea why I'm a compulsive overeater. I just am. That constantly looking to fix my problem. And you know the way it looks if you've done it like me. You say, okay, today I'm going to wake up. Actually, tomorrow morning I'm going to wake up. I'm going to have a really, you know, a really sane breakfast. Now, this is different from today, I want you to know. This is different from what I'm behaving today. Today I might have binged. Today I might have gone out for pizza. And, I didn't ever binge because I never stopped eating. Think about that. I never stopped eating. So I didn't know what it was like to eat a whole pizza because I was eating meal after meal after meal after meal. Feeling was far too difficult, I guess, because in abstinence I see that there are moments all through the day when I'm not eating. I have my 3 meals, my snacks, and that's it. And I eat a lot of food, by the way. You know, there are a lot of people who come to the program where this is going to be very, very restrictive. It's not restrictive for me at all. It's freedom producing. The part that isn't freedom producing or it's really difficult is then once the food is down, I'm powerless over food. My life is unmanageable, totally unmanageable. The child raising the adult had no tools. None. When I graduated high school, I was 13 from the bottom of my class. I had lost weight when I was turned 17. I'd had this dream, and maybe a few years earlier, and it was, I was standing in the middle of I was sitting in a bathroom in the dream, and someone says to me, is the stall next to you taken? And I say yes, and suddenly there's thunder and lightning, and the stall's transformed into the center of the football field at night. It's a night game, and God says, you lied to me. I said, so what? It's about a bathroom in the stall. He said, you won't have happiness till your 18th birthday. And I handled with him because I'm from New York. And I said, well, how about, 14? He said, 17. The 17th birthday, truthfully, I went on the Scarsdale diet. Right? Scarsdale diet was you could eat as much protein at meals and eat fruit. It was not a great diet. I lost 107 pounds on it. And I was completely utterly lost. Went back to high school in my senior year. People didn't know who I was. Thin wasn't well, by the way. I wasn't well. And within 1 or 2 years, I started binging. And someone introduced me to the program. And this was 1981, 82. And I really didn't take the program. What I took to was I took to ego and I took to hormones. And I did that for about 10 years. And that 10 years was okay ride. And then I went to graduate school. I had gone through school. I graduated high school, and I graduated after. I had to take a GED, I think, and then I couldn't study still. I couldn't memorize because I couldn't sit still. Sitting still was really difficult. Sitting with my thoughts for any period of time was really torture. So I always came up with plans, schemes to feel better about myself. And I remember it was in school, and my sister told me when going to graduate school, you know, you've done a lot of program the last 10 years, it will carry you through. Bullshit. It started a relapse I didn't realize it would last 20 years. And gaining over 120 pounds, whatever it was, over 260. And non-functional. Mental illness. Terrible relationships. Playing whack-a-mole with emotions all the time. Trying to fix my problem constantly. I said, you know, I'll come back to program after I lose my weight. If you listen to that unawakening, none of this is about struggling. None of it is about figuring out my own answer to my problem. I don't have to do that anymore. In fact, I don't. I get a myriad of help from different people, from God. It's a completely different life. About 2 years ago, I have 6.5 years of abstinence, about almost a 90-pound weight loss. That's great. It's great, you know. It's a lot nicer being than it is, you know. Shifting now isn't as bad as when I was shifting when I was heavy. But if in the morning, if I don't follow this program, if I don't work it on in every area of my life, I suffer. Not only do I suffer, the people around me suffer. I was able to go for a second graduate degree at 60. And all along the way, the first year, my girlfriend had to drive me for 6 months every day to graduate school and pick me up because I was so frightened. I get all this help to do this program. I can look around this room and I can name at least 10 to 20 people here, of these people here, who help me every day. I don't have to do anything alone. And I form this relationship with this higher power that I do not understand. It feels like a river, and I feel like I'm floating on it if I just get into it. But when I start lying, when I'm starting to be dishonest, when I'm fucking around with my food, which truthfully, that doesn't happen now. For the most part. What's the worst thing that's happened, I guess, is true. Some of the things, like, I had a sponsor, and I went to 7-Eleven, and I got a sugar-free Slurpee. And I'm having it in the car, you know, sugar-free Slurpee. And I call my sponsor. My sponsor goes, "What the fuck are you doing? Did you clear it with me?" I said, "No." He goes, "Well, isn't that what you're supposed to do?" I go, "Yeah, I guess." "But sugar-free Slurpee." He goes, "Yeah, I won't even think about it." Like, 3 months. Tough shit, right? Tough shit. The tyranny of my thoughts is so great. It's so, so great. And I believe it. I believe it. I don't have to do this alone. And the working of the tools and the trying. You know, I heard at the birthday party 2 years ago, why is it that compulsive overeaters are convinced about the outcomes of experiences they haven't had yet? How would I know what it's like to be abstinent if I'm not trying? How would I know what it's like to send the pictures 3 times a day if I'm asked to do it if I don't do it? For the first few years, a lot of my abstinence was, "Fuck you, I'll do it." The fuck you had to be there, though. Because the anger inside and the belief system inside had to be there. I couldn't handle it otherwise. And then, in the last few years, it's really exhausting to fight with me. And I'm watching other people who have this experience of recovery. And I believe them. And I want what they have. Do I like being told what to do or sometimes with suggestions? No, I don't. But I really hate the misery of only having the television, only having the food, not being able, being too frightened to do anything. And that's disease. To be so delusional, to be, you know, vibrating with anger. And that was my life for the most part. And then I came here. And I remember calling a sponsor, it may have been also called Brian too, because at dinner I have fruit that's mixed with yogurt, right, and as part of my dinner. I forgot to freeze it. I freeze it every day. And my sponsor wasn't available, and I called Brian up, and I said, Brian, you know, I forgot to do this. I want to put it in the freezer, and I'll have it in an hour. And Brian goes, we don't freeze. I don't freeze yogurt with fruit because that's ice cream. I said, motherfucker, it's not ice cream. I said, they freeze it. But you know the difference. He goes, you asked me what my experience is and what my, I'm telling you what it is and what my advice is. You can take it, you cannot take it. I don't care either way. Son of a bitch. I had the fruit and yogurt that night that wasn't frozen. Oh, well. The eating the fruit and the yogurt is a small example of being uncomfortable and it not being my way. And doing things that are not my way and asking God for help allows me to have strength and power that flows through me that I do not have. I've got dyslexia and dyscalculia, right? It's hard for me to read, it's all those things. And, you know, I use those things as excuses, right? Excuses. Are we over? We're done. Good. No. Thank you, guys, for letting me speak. Am I out of time?
No.
Oh, good. Okay, cool. Let's continue. What?
That was only 13 minutes.
Oh, that's okay. Two more minutes?
How many minutes is it? I thought it was
15.
Oh, so.
Okay, cool. You got 3 minutes. I want to tell you guys a story now before I end, which is kind of important to me. It's happened over the last few days, and it shows you about going through things where I have no idea about the answer. I'm online, and I love dogs, and I love border collies. I've had a border collie that passed away. And I see this border collie on a neighborhood website, and it's about to be put down. It's going to be euthanized either that day or the next day. And this was 4 days ago, 5 days ago. And the dog has lunged at people and has to be taken out by a rescue, an organization, not an individual person. And I look at the picture, and I see this dog, Chopper. It's a female dog, and it's frightened. It's cowering to the side. And I want to get this dog adopted. And I have no abilities to do this because I don't know anyone who will take it out. No one. So I called a rescue who put it on the site. She says, unless you have an adopter, I can't do anything. So I start calling up different rescue places to see if they'll take her. You've got to get an adopter. You've got to get an adopter. You've got to get an adopter. And I go on Facebook and I put it in, I need an adopter. And each day this dog is supposed to be taken out of the shelter. It's a 70% kill shelter at Baldwin Park. And every day, I don't know if it's dead. And this woman from Oregon, who has a cattle ranch, says, I'll take this dog. And I go back to the original rescue, and they're not even getting back to me who posted it. And then they get back to me. And I have to use all these different things. I've got a whole bunch of people involved. And this woman's going to take this dog. Each part of this, I had no belief in any of it, none of it, that it would happen. And then she says, I said, well, now we got to get this dog to this woman, and how do we do that? And she goes, well, I'll fly it up. Recovery is a lot like that. Taking these small actions, these small trust falls. And I don't get the full result in the individual moment. It just doesn't happen. But over a period of time, this thing materializes. Now, this dog could have been euthanized. It's supposed to be euthanized every day. I just did the next right indicated action. And when I do that with recovery, and I follow these things that other people have had these experiences, magical things happen. They just do. Every day. Look around you.
Thank you for letting me.